This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
The first question this month is from Russ Jenkins, and he writes, I was wondering if you had any advice for potential blind amateur astronomers. How hard would it be to get into radio astronomy? Have you heard of a NASA-related radio telescope kit? I would love to listen to the stars and planets, and if I can do this with my wife, who is blind, it would be wonderful. Thanks for any help you can give. Well, Russ, it's a very interesting question, actually. You mentioned a NASA-related radio telescope kit, and there is indeed a project called Radio Jove. That's J-O-V-E for Jupiter, Radio Jove, and you can find it on the web. We'll put the link on our website. But it's basically a kit, and you can buy various versions of the kit online. Costs about roughly $200, depending on exactly what you get, whether you put together some of the elements of the receiver yourself or whether you buy one ready-made. It's quite an arrangement, to be honest. It's basically two antennas, dipole antennas, so they're sort of stretched wires, and you have to set it up on a frame. Now, the amount of space that you need to get this kit to work is a space of about 30 foot by 45 foot. So it's a space in a fairly large back garden that you'd need, and about 10 foot high. So you've got to have these reasonably extended aerials. Now what the kit is set up to do is to pick up pretty low frequency, so around a few tens of megahertz, low frequency radio emissions from both the sun and Jupiter. Now, the sorts of things you can hear, the website for Radio Jove gives a few examples of the sorts of things you can pick up with that. But basically you hear sort of storms, if you like, solar storms. So it's basically charged particles in the magnetic field of the sun. And when there's an outburst, you hear the sort of noise level rise. But you're largely talking about the live sound you're hearing is a sort of hiss, a shh sort of sound, whose level is changing depending on what sort of solar activity there is. And then from Jupiter, it's a similar sort of thing. It's basically will sound like a hiss, sometimes with little pops and crackles in, which are again little sort of almost like little flashes of these radio waves coming from charged particles flying around the magnetic field of Jupiter. They're quite interesting, listen to at just in real time, you hear this sort of pop, pop sort of crackling noises. When you slow them down, then you hear these sort of whistling sounds, much like you can hear in the Earth's ionosphere. So it's quite an interesting project, and there's lots of examples of things you can do with the signals that you're receiving and you record on the receiver. Lots of other people working with the same kit that you can sort of share results with. But it is quite, it's a quite technical project. Largely what you're listening to live is sort of crackles and hisses and static type noises. Now, you may have heard, you mentioned listening to the stars and planets. Well, you may have heard sort of recordings of star sounds before. In fact, you may have heard them on the Jodcast. We've actually talked ourselves about these things in the past. And the August 2008 Jodcast, we had a special on sounds from space. So I encourage you to go and listen to that in our archive. But those sounds that you're hearing there are actually not things that you would hear live with any sort of instrument like one of those radio telescopes. They come from, there's various ways of making those sounds, but they're basically derived from the vibrations of the star itself. So there's sort of different motions that would occur in a star's atmosphere. Convection, the energy source it comes from within the star, deep within the star. And there's different ways in which that energy makes its way out to the surface. But towards the outer layers of a sun-like star, the main mechanism that transfers the energy is convection. So you're heating the inner parts of the star, and then the hot gas in the outer atmosphere of the star rises, and then as it rises it cools and falls back down again. So you get this sort of boiling motion. So you've got these convective cells rising and falling all the time, and it's possible to image these, to actually measure the speeds at which these cells are rising and falling using a Doppler technique, using a Doppler shift. And there's an instrument on board SOHO, for example, the satellite observing the sun, called the Michelson Doppler imager, from which sounds have been made. But they're basically derived from, there's a processing that goes on with the data before it is turned into a sound. quite excitingly, an area of astronomy called asteroseismology, or helioseismology if it applies to the sun, astero if it applies to stars in general, is to look at the vibrations of stars caused by sound waves largely moving through the body of the star. And actually, when you sort of, you could take out the sort of Doppler motions due to the convection process, you find that the star's actually vibrating, and typically the periods of these vibrations are about 5 minutes. That's the sort of dominant mode there is in the vibration of the sun. And that sort of almost a little pulsation with a period of roughly 5 minutes causes a change in temperature of the sun, which results in a change in brightness. So in fact, what's done is to monitor the brightness of the star over a period of time. And what you're looking for are these regular changes in brightness, the dominant period of which is 5 minutes. And so you then just turn those changes in brightness into a sound. So you just scale that. So, you know, so if it's brighter, it'd be a louder sound, or fainter, it'd be a quieter sound. And then the different frequencies of change, the different periods with which the brightness changes, lead to different frequencies in the audio spectrum that you hear. So of course, you know, a period of 5 minutes would lead to a very, very low frequency, which would be completely inaudible. So the sounds that you hear when they're turned into sounds have been speeded up by a huge factors of over 200,000 times faster than the actual changes that you in fact see from the brightness changes. So that's sort of 18 octaves, 2 to the power 18 increase in frequency in order to get it into the audible range. So in fact, you know, that isn't really feasible to sort of point a telescope and listen to a sound from a star, because these things were never originally sounds anyway. They're just translated from brightness changes. Plus there's all this sort of speeding up that has to be done as well to get it into sound anything like the interesting sort of sounds we hear. If you go listen to the podcast we did back in 2008. Now, just reading around the subject on this, I just came across, I don't know whether you've come across this or not, but there's a very interesting series of books by someone called Noreen Grice, who works in the States, and she's produced a series of Braille books on astronomy where she's basically taken astronomical images, produced a book with these sort of, for example, lovely Hubble Space Telescope images, and then each of the pictures has a plastic overlay, a transparent plastic overlay, which you can put over the picture, and that is, on the transparent overlay, you can actually feel the picture effectively. So there's a representation of the picture underneath that you can feel, together with Braille text that describes the various features that you can feel in the image. So that looks very interesting. And again, we'll put a link to that on our webpage. And probably just on a local note, we're planning here at Jodrell Bank a new visitor facility. And one of the things we're hoping to do is, with the building itself, we're hoping to be able to build a building which has embossed into the structure of the building, into the walls of the building, patterns that relate to the science that we do here. So, for example, one of the things we're thinking about doing is to emboss into the building the radio sky. So the invisible radio sky, a map of the sky which was created with the Lovell telescope here, the Parkes radio telescope in Australia, and the Effelsberg telescope in Germany. And so taking a sort of contour map of that radio image and embossing it into the building means that you can actually sort of feel directly where the bright spots are. You feel Cassiopeia A, the star that exploded in 1670, that's very bright in the radio sky. Cygnus A, the distant radio galaxy with a supermassive black hole, you could feel as well. And also the center of the Milky Way, the black hole at the center of the Milky Way, as well as the overall ridge of emission that runs along the plane of the Milky Way. So we're keeping our fingers crossed that we'll be able to do that and that we obtain the funding for those buildings, but that will be an interesting thing as and when that comes. So thanks very much for that question, Russ, and I hope that's some help to you. The second question this month is from Anthony Bradbury, and he says, many years ago, one of your staff gave a talk at my then radio club, Telford and District Radio Society, and this member of the Jodrell Bank team was a radio ham, and he can't remember his name. I suspect it may well have been Ian Morrison, our night sky specialist. Anthony writes, I wish to recall the data he showed on the radar received at Jodrell Bank during the time of the landing phase of Apollo 11. Now, what I think we'll do is we'll actually get a scan made of the data that was picked up here at Jodrell Bank, and we'll put it on the gallery pages on our website so that everybody can have a look. It's actually visible, it's on display in our visitor centre. What we actually did was to pick up one of the carrier signals being produced by the Eagle lander, which has been sent out at a particular frequency. So we're picking up a radio signal. It wasn't radar specifically, so we weren't sending out a signal, but we were receiving a radio signal from the Eagle lander, and we were able to measure its frequency, and we were able to see the frequency change as a result of the changing motion between us and the Eagle lander. So basically a Doppler shift. So as the lander in effect moved faster away from us, or somewhat more slowly away from us, changes in velocity between the two, between ourselves and the Eagle lander, we're able to see that as changes in the frequency. And that's a plotted, what we have as a recording of that is a plot of the frequency against time. And what you can actually see on that, you see the trace wiggle up and down quite a lot at the beginning, and that's actually just some very rapid changes in frequency, and they're being corrected for on the scale. So there's some sort of sharp changes that are just corrections to the calibration. But then the interesting thing is that you start the thing settles down, but then you see some little wiggles in the trace, and those wiggles are actually the point at which Neil Armstrong had to take manual control of the Eagle lander, because he'd realized that the computer had been programmed in to land at a certain point, that patch of the moon was actually very rough with many boulders and little craters and things, and he was worried about landing on that point. So he took manual control and flew it over the rough ground, and you can actually see the sort of effectively the bumping up and down of the Eagle lander as he was flying it under manual control in this trace. And then what you see is that the trace goes very smooth, and that very smooth change that it changes to is the point where the Eagle lander has landed on the moon. There's no more sort of bumping up and down as he's flying it over the surface. It's sitting stationary on the moon's surface, and the only change in frequency that we then picked up was the change in frequency that's just due to the relative changes due to the rotation of the Earth relative to the position of the lander on the moon and the moon in its orbit. So it's really quite an exciting bit of data, but we'll put that on our web pages for you to have a look at. It's probably also worth looking back through some of our archive Jodcasts for interviews that we've done with Sir Bernard Lovell here in the past, where we've talked about the various things that Jodrell was involved in, because we weren't actually officially involved in the lunar landing story in Apollo 11, but we were involved as a formal partner in various missions earlier on in the space race. So even prior to Apollo itself, in the early Project Able missions, where the Americans had decided to try and get a rocket to the moon, Jodrell was officially asked to be involved in that in terms of tracking those rockets. And of course, we did some very interesting things relating to the right from the very first artificial satellite, Sputnik 1, picking up the rocket that took Sputnik into space by sending out a radar signal and getting an echo back off that rocket, tracking the other ones, Sputnik 2, Laika, the dog, through to picking up the first pictures ever sent from the surface of the moon on Luna 9 in 1966 that soft landed on the moon, sent back pictures that were intercepted here at Jodrell Bank with an early type of fax machine. Picking up signals from the first spacecraft ever to enter the atmosphere of another planet, on the planet Venus. Loads of interesting things back from in the archive of Jodrell Bank's activities in space. But I guess, you know, in terms of that story culminating in the landing on the moon, and we do have quite an interesting bit of data there that I'll make available on our website. And I think the final question this month is from Audra Copeland, and she says, she sends a message asking about a gold-coloured star. She says she lives in Nashua, New Hampshire, and she was out walking one evening, 10:30 p.m., March the 7th, and wondered about a particular star that she could see in the sky that was seemed a very gold colour, seemed a lot brighter than the stars around it. Seemed a lot brighter and a lot larger than the stars around it. Do we know what that was? Well, I got in touch with Audra and checked on whereabouts in this, what direction she was looking in, and I'm pretty sure that the star she was talking about was actually a planet, and it was actually the planet Mars, because we've come probably aware, towards the end of January, we came very close to Mars, at least in the sense that, you know, as the Earth orbits around the Sun, Mars orbits around the Sun farther away from the Sun than we are. And because we're closer to the Sun, we orbit faster. And so we sort of overtake Mars on the inside every couple of years. And as we pass by on the inside, we're as close as we get basically to Mars. So it looks very bright in the sky, towards midnight on the opposite side of the sky to the Sun. And so the end of January, we were as close as we were going to get. We're sort of receding away from Mars again now. Mars will gradually fade, but it was very spectacular. It did look sort of goldy coloured, reddish gold coloured, and very bright over to the sort of left of Orion. So yeah, that seemed like certainly was Mars. Of course, the reddish colour comes from the colour of the rusty sort of sandy soil on Mars. There's a point there about saying it looked a lot brighter. It certainly was brighter than most of the stars. You know that these things are planets. Historically, people would have looked at these things and seen that they wandered around the sky differently than the other stars, not realizing what they were, gave them the name Planetes, which comes from the Greek for wanderer, which is where we get planet from. And we know they wander across the sky now because actually they're going round and round the Sun, and so they're moving against the distant background of the stars. Mentioning that it looks a lot larger than the rest around it, of course, you know, if you look at Mars through a telescope, you would be able to see that it was a disk. It wasn't a sort of point source twinkling like the other stars tend to do, rather more steady in its brightness and actually looking like a disk, so resolved, because it's, you know, much closer to us. You can actually see the shape of it. In fact, if you're lucky, even visually at the moment, if it's nice clear night, nice steady atmosphere, you can even see some features on the Martian surface, like, for example, the polar caps looking a bit whiter. So, of course, it doesn't look bigger to the naked eye, really. I think that's just an illusion, really, caused by it appearing brighter. So it appears to be sort of, appears larger. In fact, to the naked eye, you wouldn't really be able to see that. It would just be that it would be brighter. But through a telescope, you can indeed see that it's a disk rather than a point-like object. And one of the things that's often pointed out about planets is to look for the fact that they probably don't twinkle like the stars do. So the twinkling is caused by the light passing through the atmosphere and refracting through the atmosphere, and you sort of get little brightenings and fadings due to the sort of turbulence in the atmosphere. And because a planet is actually extended rather than a point, the light from the overall from the planet's disk is actually passing through sufficient different lines of sight through the atmosphere that those are all sort of averaged out, and so you don't get that same twinkling pattern. Okay, that's all the questions we have for this month. So please send in any future questions in the usual way, and we'll speak again next month.